All right, welcome back to the listener's commentary on the Gospel of Matthew. In this recording, we're going to begin looking at Matthew chapter 18, verses 1 through 20. There's quite a bit of material in here, particularly in the second half, so we're going to take it in two parts. In this recording, we'll take the first part, which will look at verses 1 through 14, and then in the next recording, we'll look at the second part, which will be 15 through 20. And we need to keep this whole chunk together because it really revolves around one theme and begins with one question. So it really is a literary unit. We're just going to take it in two parts for the sake of the recording. And to keep in mind the overall broader context of Matthew's gospel, this section begins the fourth large teaching block in Matthew. And this teaching block comes in two pieces, 18:1 through 20, and then 21 and following. And each part is initiated by a question asked by the disciples. And that's really why we have to take verses 1 through 20 all together. There's one question that initiates this following discussion. And then midway through the chapter at 18:21, the disciples ask a second question, and that leads to the next half of this large teaching block. And so we are going to focus here in these next two recordings on 18:1 through 20, and it revolves, really, the whole chapter revolves around relationships in Jesus' kingdom. And so many scholars refer to this teaching block as the community teaching block. The first question that we get in verse 1 has to do with status and greatness in the kingdom. So here the disciples come, they ask Jesus this. At that time, the disciples came to Jesus and said, "Who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" This is a question about status. And status and honor were huge values in the world at large of Jesus' day. And even though our culture in some ways is significantly different regarding how status and honor play out, it's still a big deal. Who's the GOAT? Who's the greatest of all time? Who's the best, right? Who deserves honor? Who needs the right? We still wrestle with this question of greatness. Well, that's the question. Status, honor, greatness in the kingdom of heaven. Here's how Jesus responds to the question. "And he called a child to himself and set him among them." And so he brings this child to himself, sets it down so everyone can see. And he said, "Truly I say to you, unless you change and become like children, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven." And so the kingdom of heaven, the values and the manner and the approach of the kingdom of heaven in some sort of way is like a child. And this child that Jesus is holding or sitting on his lap for everyone to see is a living concrete example of whatever this value is, whatever the nature of the kingdom is that says, become like children. So become like children in what way? And frankly, in preaching and teaching among Bible scholars, there's been all sorts of speculation when Jesus says this sorts of stuff, which he does at various points in his ministry in the different gospels. Oh, you need to be like a children like this. You need to be like a children like that. What's really helpful is, in this specific instance, Jesus tells us what he means by become like a child. So in what way do we need to become like a child? Well, look at verse 4. "So whoever will humble himself like a child, he is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven." So the disciples asked Jesus a question about greatness. Who's the greatest? Who's the best? Who really deserves to be elevated, put upon a pedestal, given great honor and treated with honor? Jesus says, you need to become like a child. And specifically, when he makes the point in verse 4, he tells us, here's how you need to become like a child. You need to humble yourself like this child. Humble has to do with lowliness. You need to lower yourself. In other words, this child has little power, very little social power, very little status, very little honor. While children among the Jews could be loved and valued in that sense, they did not have social standing. They did not have social power. They were not highly honored. And that's the point. If you want to go up in the kingdom of heaven, you need to go down and become like a child. You need to lower your status. You need to give up the game of honor seeking and greatness seeking. That's the point. Humble yourself and become like the child. Jesus goes on in verse 5 and says, "And whoever receives one such child in my name receives me. In other words, welcome. That's the idea of receives, to welcome, to accept. Like, you welcome this in. And notice what Jesus has done in verse 5, one such child. I think that seems to go beyond a literal child. Jesus had just said, we need to become like a child. We need to become lowly, small, little, if we want to enter the kingdom of heaven. And now he refers to one such like that. And it seems that he's saying someone that has become like a child. If you welcome some little one, right? And that's the idea, which is probably why Jesus shifts to that phrase, little one, in what follows. And so if you welcome or receive someone who has become like a child, someone who has little status, someone who is small, it's all those little people out there. We still use that phrase sometimes even in English. And so Jesus goes on in verse 6 and says, but whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to sin, it's better for him that a heavy millstone be hung around his neck and that he be drowned in the depths of the sea. Now, remember, Jesus is in Galilee. They're all familiar with the sea. Maybe he's right by the sea, and he turns and gestures towards the sea, and he's saying, if someone causes one of these little ones who believe in me, that little one who believes in me includes children, right? A literal child, but also all the small or seemingly unimportant or powerless ones who believe in Jesus. That's the idea. The ordinary people, the little people, right? That's the idea that Jesus is getting at. Whoever causes one of those kinds of people who believe in Jesus to sin, it's better for him that a heavy millstone be hung around his neck. And that phrase, causes them to sin. We need to clarify that a little bit. I just don't really appreciate that translation, particularly because of what follows. The basic meaning of the verb is cause to stumble. And it would be helpful to translate it that way here, because in verse 7 and following, Jesus is going to talk about stumbling blocks. And that word stumbling block in verse 7 and following is the noun form of this verb. They're the same word, just one is a verb and one is a noun. And you lose that verbal connection. You can't hear it when they translate the verb cause to sin and they translate the noun stumbling block. But those two words go together. And the idea is not just you cause somebody to trip or you cause them to make a little mistake. The idea of the word stumbling block is that you do something so that their faith is destroyed, their faith is ruined. And we will see in what follows what Jesus has to say about that and how strongly he feels about that. Here, he makes it clear how strongly he feels by saying that if you do that, if you do something in such a way that you destroy another person's faith, it's better for you that a heavy millstone, that is a large millstone. There were small millstones. There were hand millstones. This is the large millstone, the type that was usually turned by an ox or a donkey. This big, massive, large, heavy millstone. It's better for that to be tied around your neck and to have you thrown in a sea than to cause one of these little ones who believe in Jesus have their faith destroyed. And in fact, Jesus feels so strongly about that that he goes on in verse 7 to pronounce a woe on those who do that, a woe on those who are stumbling blocks. Look at verse 7. Woe to the world because of its stumbling blocks. And as I noted, the word stumbling block is just the noun of the verb that's translated cause to sin up above. They're the same word. And in context, what we're talking about is doing something that will cause another person to fall and have their faith destroyed. So Jesus goes on and says, for it's inevitable that stumbling blocks come, right? He just said, woe to the world. Again, we're outside of that point of we're just to the world itself. It's inevitable in this fallen world that stumbling blocks will come. But woe to the person through whom the stumbling block comes. In other words, in this world, you're going to have stumbling blocks. Just don't be that person. Don't be the one who is a stumbling block that destroys another person's faith. And because that's so serious and that's such a big deal, Jesus says to his followers, you need to take your actions with utter seriousness, with deep seriousness. Look what he says in verses 8 and 9. He says, So if your hand or your foot causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away from you. It's better for you to enter into life maimed or without a foot than to have two hands or two feet and be thrown into the eternal fire. And if your eye is causing you to sin, tear it out, throw it away from you. It's better for you to enter life with one eye than to have two eyes and be thrown into the fiery hell. This is not intended to be taken literally. Jesus isn't literally telling us to cut off our hand, cut off our foot, pluck out our eye. It's a graphic picture for how seriously we ought to take sinful behavior and sinful behavior that destroys other people's faith, how seriously we need to deal with sin. And the point is, do whatever it takes. Do whatever is necessary. Remove whatever from your life. Remove whatever is leading you in that direction. Take sin seriously and get rid of whatever is leading you to it. Jesus actually used this same imagery already in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 5, and there it was specifically in the context of dealing with sexual lust. Here, it's broad. It's for any sin. Like whatever might cause you to sin, get rid of it from your life. And it's also in context dealing with the impact on others. You don't want to be that stumbling block who deserves that heavy millstone put around your neck. So take sin seriously. Remove whatever you can from your life that leads you into it. In fact, he goes on in verse 10 and says, "See, beware, make sure that you do not look down on one of these little ones." In other words, in context with what he's saying, what precedes it, the idea of look down is don't treat with contempt. Don't treat with scorn. Don't disregard or care nothing for. So here's all these. You might have status. You might have influence. You might have power even within the kingdom. And you just disregard all the little disciples out there. That's the idea. And as a result, you don't worry so much about, you know, this little shady deal here or this little sin over here. It's not a big deal. And Jesus is like, no, don't disregard them. Why not? Well, because of how valuable they are to God. Look what Jesus says in the second half of verse 10. "For I say to you that their angels," that is the angels of these little ones, the angels of those little ordinary disciples, "their angels in heaven continually see the face of my Father who is in heaven." So why should you not look down on them, disregard them, care nothing for them? Because of how valuable they are in heaven. Their angel, there was this common Jewish idea of a guardian angel, right? That was very typical that each person in Jewish tradition had an angel assigned to them to look after them and to watch over them. And that angel stands in the very presence of God. Jesus is appealing to that and saying here that these ordinary disciples, the ones you look down on and think are so unimportant, look how valuable they are. In heaven itself, their angel stands right before the Father who is in heaven. And so in context, the thought is that this person, this disciple, may not have much status. They may seem small or unimportant or insignificant to you, but they are known and cherished in heaven, right in the very presence of God. It makes me think of that famous line in a powerful paragraph from a sermon C.S. Lewis once preached called Weight of Glory. And in that sermon, C.S. Lewis says, "There are no ordinary people." And what does he mean by that? Well, these people have eternal lives. And he actually says they'll become either an eternal horror or an eternal glory. Like there are no ordinary people. And so the impact that we have on people really matters because people matter immensely to God. And not only are they valued in heaven, but God doesn't want any of these little ones to perish. That is, he doesn't want any of them to have their faith destroyed because we've become a stumbling block. So look at verses 12 and 13. Jesus says, "What do you think? If any man has 100 sheep and one of them goes astray, will he not leave the 99 on the mountains and go search for the one that is lost? And if it turns out that he finds it, truly, I say to you, he rejoices over it more than the 99 that have not gone astray. So it is not the will of your Father who is in heaven for any one of these little ones to perish. The idea of this is that the little mini illustration here is that a person, a good shepherd, goes and looks for that one little sheep that has wandered off and got away from the fold. And so he goes and looks for that. Well, guess what? God has that same heart. And God doesn't want any one of these little ones, one of these people who are low and small in the kingdom of heaven, he doesn't want any of them to perish. And since they have gone astray, since they have wandered off, God's going to find them. And since they have done that, the implication by extension is that we should do the same sort of thing. We don't want them to be lost either. We don't want them to perish either. And thus, we need to make sure we don't become a stumbling block to them. And so this whole section has begun with the question, who's the greatest? And what Jesus helped us see is you have to understand God's value system is different. God values lowliness and smallness and humility and those of powerlessness and no status in a way that we can barely even imagine. So much so that he hunts them down, he rescues them, he protects them, and he wants us to do the same sort of thing, to care for them, to love them, to value them, and not to be a stumbling block to them. And so as we wrap up this first half of this this section, let me just offer this reflection, and it really revolves around this theme, that in the kingdom of heaven, we need to renounce status seeking. One commentator points out that the establishment of and the preservation of status and position were fundamental values in the first century world. That was what you sought to do. You wanted to establish your honor and your status, and you needed to preserve and protect your status and your honor. That's the way society worked. And so, in a certain sense, it's not surprising that the disciples asked Jesus about greatness. What is surprising is how Jesus responds. He basically undermines, subverts the entire well-established social order that was all around them in culture at large. This status seeking and preservation of status, it was just related to the value of honor. And Jesus points out that to gain honor in his kingdom actually requires doing the opposite of what one person needs to do in society. In society, you seek to go up. You seek wealth. You seek, right? You seek to get ahead. You seek to make something of yourself. You seek to look good and have people think good of you. But in Jesus' kingdom, to gain honor is to go down. To gain honor requires lowering yourself and becoming status-free like a little child rather than exalting yourself like everyone else does. And thus, Jesus' answer challenged the status quo and conventional wisdom. In God's kingdom, greatness entails lowliness and concern for the lowly and the least of these. In God's kingdom, we turn away from status seeking and we acquire honor by imitating Jesus. Jesus, who existed in the form of God, but emptied himself and lowered himself all the way to the point of death on a cross, Philippians chapter 2, 5 and following. And we imitate that by renouncing status seeking, and we acquire honor by practicing the same sort of self-emptying for the sake of others, just like Jesus did for us. All right, in the next session, we'll take up the second half of Jesus' discussion of this question, and it really follows up on the heels of this, looking about, all right, well, what if someone is a stumbling block? And what if somebody is gone astray? How do we deal with that? So we'll take that up in the next recording. So thanks for tuning into this session on the Listener's Commentary on the New Testament. The Listener's Commentary is a listener-supported, crowd-funded Bible teaching ministry that is made possible by the generous support of people like you. We're able to give all this away for free because people are generously donating and providing for it. So thanks a ton for your support. And if you want to join the team of supporters, you can do so by going to listenerscommentary.com, clicking the Give button. It'll redirect you to a page through World Family Mission, my page specifically, where you can put in a dollar amount, click a little box that says Make This Monthly, or leave it a one-time donation. And all of that will help this ministry continue to grow and flourish so that we can help people learn and live the Bible. Thanks a ton for your support.